You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 30, Holographic Vaporization. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including convention additions, movie rumors, IDW's Star Trek Ongoing number 4, and clues to the next movie that are hidden in the comics. We'll also preview two more tracks from Five Year Mission's new album, Year 2. And in the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher as we discuss the Voyager episode Worst Case Scenario and the Maquis Starfleet relationship. So let's step into the Ready Room. Happy New Year, Greg.
Happy New Year, Chris. Did you have a good one?
Yeah, I did. It was very busy, of course, with family things, but I suppose relaxing at the same time. I managed to stay away from my home and my studio for the entire day on New Year's Day.
Oh, wow.
Which is the best way to prevent me from actually, you know, working on anything.
And, right.
But, you know, Mother Nature also sent us a very prompt New Year's greeting with our very first earthquake of the year. We got, I think, 14 hours into 2012 before we had an earthquake.
They just will not let you go. I mean, it was off the coast, right? So it wasn't too strong in Tokyo, but I'm sure it's more than you'd want.
Yeah, it was pretty strong rattle. I mean, it wasn't like the March 11th quake, but it was off the coast and it was very deep. You know, which reminds me, Greg, I don't know if a lot of our listeners know how you and I met, but just as a little tidbit for everyone out there, everyone knows that Greg used to live in Japan as well, and Greg was actually in Sendai right at the epicenter of the Big March quake, and Greg and I met as a result of that earthquake through Twitter.
Yeah.
It's funny how those things work out, right?
Yeah, it really does. it's amazing what social networking can do, you know, in the wake of the quake, like in the first couple hours. Twitter was the main way I was getting news about it, not just because it was available, but because it was the only site I could get to. I couldn't get to CNN. I couldn't get to MSNBC. Yeah. And it was even the way I was communicating with family and friends back home, because emails weren't going through, international text wasn't working. So I was using Twitter. And then in the months afterwards, I met a whole bunch of people, including you, just by, you know, searching earthquake, seeing who my friends were talking to. So it's been really great. Like, as far as meeting people, it was amazing after the earthquake what was able to happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm happy to be leaving 2011 behind. You know, it will always be the year of the earthquake. I don't know. You know, I was weird analogy to make, but Ewan McGregor was talking in the episode 2 or 3 commentary about how these are the biggest films he's ever done and he can ever imagine doing. So I can't imagine being a part of something more, you know, life changing than the earthquake, you know, something bigger than that. So I certainly hope not, but yeah. I expect it will be standing out heavily in my mind as something that made 2011 what it was. So yes, I'm very happy to be back here where there was not an earthquake on New Year's Day. I'm sorry that that happened to you guys, certainly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, no harm done, but it certainly wasn't the first thing that we wanted to start the year. But it's amazing how all that worked out, and thus the Ready Room was born. So that's a good thing from 2011. But
yeah.
Now, I did want to ask you, Greg, on the last show, we did talk about your new Christmas tradition of going to McDonald's and watching Shades of Grey on your iPad. Now, do you have a similar New Year's tradition that you've begun?
Well, I did get my internet installed on New Year's Eve. I was very happy. A young man named Lucas came by while I was watching Star Wars. Nice little coincidence there. And installed my internet. And I actually spent the rest of the day pretty much just getting caught up on TV. And once New Year's, you know, evening rolled around, I pretty much turned on Battlestar Galactica and just watched it until about 1 or 2 a.m. So if Shades of Grey is my Christmas tradition so far, Battlestar Galactica is my new New Year's tradition. I'm hoping, you know, I don't make New Year's resolutions anymore, thanks Merlin Mann and Dan Benjamin on the not on the talk show, on Back to Work, 5x5 Network. But don't make New Year's resolutions anymore. But this year, I do plan to watch Battlestar Galactica all the way through one more time. It's amazing how you start picking up on nuances again. It's a show a lot like DS9, which is another show I need to start watching through again. It's amazing the nuances you pick up on a show like that the more times you watch it, especially something written with a mind towards detail and with an idea of this whole world that's being created. So I really enjoyed watching Battlestar. You know, I thought I might have some plans for going out New Year's Eve, but in the end, I think I really prefer spending the time for myself, and then I can wake up New Year's Day, it's New Year's Day as I'm recording it, and just have a good, relaxing day and not have to worry about recovering from the escapades from the night before.
That's true. Yeah, for sure. We had a late night here, not out partying, but, you know, late night with the family things. Everyone slept in pretty late today. All right. Well, why don't we jump into some Star Trek news and see what we've got here, Greg. The first thing, and this is, I guess, why I was wondering if you had one tradition here, is Nichelle Nichols' birthday happened just a little bit after we recorded the last show on December 28th. And she turned 79. And I wonder now, each year when Nichelle's birthday comes around, do you dress up in the feathers from Star Trek V and get up on the hilltop and sing Before the Moon?
I've been working on it. You know, my performance is a little lacking. I'm a little flat. But the feathers are done. I mean, the outfit is good. You know, my legs don't look quite as good as Nichelle's quite yet. Working on that. The biggest problem is the song. You know, it's hitting those notes is just, you know, you need to be someone like Nichelle Nichols to really hit those notes.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you keep up, keep working on it, maybe next year.
Yeah.
For Nichelle's 80th birthday, you'll be ready to sing that.
Well, that's what I've been aiming for. You know, the last 20 years, you know, I missed her 60th birthday because I wasn't born yet. Or I wasn't, you know, I was just a little bit old. And then by the time she was 70, I didn't have it. So I've been working these last 10 years on really nailing the song. So by her 80th birthday, that's really what I'm aiming
all
for.
Right. Well, it sounds like a great goal. And we'll pick a really nice mountain for you to stand on there. And we're going to send like an entire film crew out there to record you, and then we'll put it in the ready room. However, I'm lining up someone else to sing it, and I'm going to replace your vocals with their vocals on the show.
You're going to get Zoe Saldana again, aren't you? I'm tired of Zoe Saldana replacing me in everything.
Well, she does look better. I mean, I know that picture that someone, I wonder who created, of you and the scamp was going around Twitter last week. I do have to say that Zoe does look better in that than you do.
I do hope that's not the poster image on the Enhanced podcast for this segment. I really hope it's not. And at the same time, I hope it is.
Hey, maybe it will be. But anyway, you know, Nichelle has been one of the most...
happy birthday, Nichelle.
Yes, happy birthday to Nichelle. One of the most enduring faces from the original series, and I think one of the most inspirational from the original series, inspiring so many, not only girls and women over the years, but everyone of minorities as well, if you want to call them that. I think we're all pretty much, you know, a minority, depending on where we are. Yeah. I certainly am, where I live. But just a great story, a great woman who has been with us for so many years, and hopefully we'll have her with us for quite a few more.
Yeah, I really need to see her. I hear she's one of the ones who does conventions really well, and she's just so gracious to the fans and has great stories to tell. I really hope I can see her at a convention. Every time I see her in an interview, she's just so great, and she's so inspirational, and it's really great to see that. And I'm glad that people like Whoopi Goldberg and Zoe Saldana have continued the tradition of these strong female minority roles in Star Trek. Hopefully that'll continue into the next series, into the next animated series, whatever it is that Star Trek is always, you know, pushing the limits of what happens on TV. You know, her role was pushing the limits back in the 60s, and we'll see how they can be pushing things forward in this decade as well.
Yeah, and she's remained quite active, you know, quite a few interviews just recently that I've seen her in, talking about the space program and, you know, Star Trek inspirations and so forth. And also, we were just talking about the earthquake, you know, just earlier from last year. And if you remember, right after the quake, she was actually signing photographs, and raising money to help the Japan quake relief as well. So just, you know, really active in all sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah, she was the one behind the Sing While Wearing Feathers for Japan campaign, wasn't she?
I think so. They certainly had a good poster for that campaign. No doubt. All right. Well, happy birthday again to Nichelle Nichols.
Indeed.
All right. Well, talking about other actors, we have a few updates on conventions, Greg. Of course, everyone's looking forward to Star Trek Las Vegas for next year. And there are a number of other conventions that Creation is doing in May in Philadelphia, June in Nashville, confirmed already. Mm-hmm. And we already know quite a few people who are going to be attending, but we did find out that Sir Patrick Stewart will be appearing in Philadelphia May 4th through 6th of next year. Well, actually, it's this year now, 2012. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's hard for me to believe, because I remember when the show came on, that this year will mark the 25th anniversary of TNG conventions.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is really amazing. I was watching some TNG this week and realizing, not that the show looks cheap, but that it definitely does have that look of an 80s show.
Yeah.
And it is really starting to show its age, especially compared to something like DS9 or, you know, we were watching Voyager this week, and it really has, you know, the production design has really improved since then. So it's not that it's looking dated, especially like the original series, but I can believe that it's been the 25th anniversary. But somehow Patrick Stewart has not aged. I mean, maybe he aged a little bit between like Farpoint and First Contact, but I don't think he's aged since First Contact.
No, it doesn't seem like it. He just looks the same, absolutely. He's a very fit, healthy Knight of the Round Table. Is he a Knight of the Round Table?
I don't know if he is a he is a knight.
But he does not say nee, nee, does he?
Oh man.
Oh, okay. But it's going to be great. Everyone attending Philadelphia to be able to see him there, and And I think he's also going to be in Nashville. That's June 9th through 10th.
Oh yeah.
And Greg, I know you're looking forward to this. Someone has been added to Star Trek Las Vegas. And that's Avery Brooks.
Ah, yes. Will he be playing the piano?
I think so. They should do that. They should have a session like in one of the bars late night, you know, about 11 p.m. Everyone's sitting there, have a drink, have Avery up there just playing piano in the dark bar. That'd be awesome.
Nice.
Maybe then you'd actually be able to follow what he's talking about.
Maybe. That would improve it. Now, are any of these convention appearances going to be anywhere near me? You know, I'm here in the Pacific Northwest, and I keep hearing about things in Philadelphia, things in Chicago, things in Las Vegas.
Well, I guess Las Vegas isn't too far away, although I remember when I lived in Reno, I would have friends from the East Coast who would say, oh, I'm going to be in Las Vegas next weekend. Maybe we should get together for drinks. And I'm like, well, do you know how large Nevada is?
Right,
it's about an 8-hour drive from Reno to Las Vegas, but sure.
Well,
yeah, let's do that.
I did want to mention, I will be at, you know, everything permitting, I will be at the Emerald City Comic Con in March, which is in Seattle. Larry Nemechek, who was with us a couple weeks ago, will also be there. So if any of our listeners are coming out for Emerald City or live in Seattle and will be there, be sure to hit us up on Twitter and mention that you'll be there. And hopefully somebody from IDW will be there. Some of the artists or writers from the comic will be there. They haven't made all their announcements as far as that. It's a Comic-Con, and it's not, you know, Comic-Con from San Diego. So there's probably not going to be too much Hollywood stuff there. But hopefully we'll see a little bit of Star Trek things there, you know, until an actual Star Trek convention is announced for Seattle.
Yeah, that would be fun to go to. I wish I don't get to go to any conventions around here.
Yeah.
There's nothing happening around me. You're a lot closer to them than I am.
Well, there was that. We did go to that one convention, the design convention. It's just Star Trek actors there either.
No, but they did have a transporter room. Remember that? And what was that room? That
I
was
don't
like
even
a
know. Was it like a refrigerator or something?
Maybe. I don't know. It was just like a big metal box with lights inside.
Yeah.
It had a light inside, right?
There's a light at the top to give that nice top down light look.
Yeah. And you stood in there and I took your picture with my iPhone camera, and it was kind of out of focus, but it actually created the effect that you were standing on a transporter.
It really did. I was about to, you know, head down to Vulcan and save my parents' lives.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me, we've never implemented our plan to wear those gigantic goggle headgear setups do the Ready Room. We'd be kind of like Breen a little bit, right?
A little bit. Oh, man.
Of course, if we spoke like Breen, no one would be able to understand us.
You know, there was a character named Breen in Super 8. It was the weirdest Star Trek reference I've ever heard, because who would reference the Breen as a character, you know, in the 80s who's like a gas station employee who just happens to be named Breen?
Johnny Breen.
It wasn't even Johnny Breen. First name? Breen. That was his name.
Breen. My name's Breen. Can I fuel up your tank?
Exactly.
All right. Well, what else do we have going on with the conventions? Anything else here? Any news? I think just, you know, a rundown of everyone who we've already know is going to be there. You know, Frakes and Spiner and Colmini and John Delancey. I'm pretty sure Chase Masterson will be there, Greg, if you want to run down. And also, I'm excited, of course, because Diana Muldaur is going to be in Las Vegas, I believe. So I can get my Pulaski on.
Perfect. I'll have to strap you down to a table.
And make me relive memories of Dr. Pulaski.
Yes. You know, I was watching, we'll be getting to our feature later on, but I just noticed that Robert Duncan McNeil is going to be there. He is Kirk and he is Riker. You wouldn't think, but they keep demoting this character that sort of acts the same way. In the first show, he was a captain. In the second show, he's a commander. And now he's a lieutenant junior grade. But he's that same sort of go-get him personality, always willing to punch first, ask questions later. And of course, what do they have in the episode we're going to do? Two Parises. Just like
that's right.
You've always got to have two Kirks, two Rikers.
That's right.
We can never have enough of this guy.
Right. You can never have enough Paris.
So I hope I hope both copies of Robert Duncan McNeil will be at Star Trek Las Vegas.
Maybe so. I just hope they don't try to shoot each other. And then the convention ends.
Yes.
Right?
No more has been written.
That's right. All right. Well, why don't we move on to our next thing here? Of course, we'll have more convention news on the site as it comes up and keep everyone apprised of what's happening on that front. Yep. And if you want the packages for Star Trek Las Vegas, get over to the Creation website, because they are on sale now, I believe. At least the top-end packages are. And although they're pricey, I'm sure that they will not last long. All right. Well, Greg, why don't we hop over? You know, we didn't preview any tracks from Five-Year Mission last week, as we did our year-end show, Rudolph in the Original Klingon. I'm still waiting for Five-Year Mission to record that holiday album.
They're really supposed to, you know, yeah. Christmas on the Demon Planet, I think.
If they could do a joint holiday album with the El Troubadour Klingon Music Project, that could be really a new holiday tradition in my house.
Ka-plot du-ska bu-shant-de-ka.
I don't even know what to say about that. Although I do see you holding up that bottle of blood wine right there.
Yes, my New Year's begins now.
Do you think they have blood nog on the Klingon homeworld?
That sounds delicious, actually. Blood nog.
Blood nog spiked with blood wine. Maybe that's what Claw was drinking.
Very possibly.
All right. Well, what do we have for Five-Year Mission this week? Why don't we jump in? We have just a few more tracks to preview here.
You know,
we've been doing two per show. We're getting close to the end of the album, and now we're going to have to wait, I guess, till the Tribble EP comes out.
Yeah, I heard someone, was it...
something new to go.
Was it Mike or was it Noah? Someone was recording the acoustic demo of their Tribble song this week. So progress is being made.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that tweet. I've been out so much, disconnected from everything, but... I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so why don't we play first this week, The City on the Edge of Forever.
Back in time to retrieve our doctor. There I found the lover of the
You know, this is probably my favorite song on the album. You know, maybe aside from, now I'm forget, Tomorrow Is Yesterday, this is my favorite. Yeah. Is there something about ones like this one and Arena? We've got to imagine there was a lot of pressure going in when you drew that song out of the urn, the hat, the I forget what it was.
Skull? Wasn't there a skull?
The skull. When you draw the song out of the skull, there's got to be a lot of pressure because it's a really well-known episode, and figuring out how to sum it up in a song has to be just really, really stressful. And I thought it was handled really well with this song. Got the spirit of it across.
Yeah, it did. I was curious what they were going to do with this episode, and I guess you could take two approaches. You can focus on the Kirk Edith Keeler relationship, or you could go like all punk psychedelic with drug crazed McCoy.
Yeah, that could definitely work.
Maybe on the B sides, the album full of B sides, we'll get that.
I'll
one.
Do that. You know, I was kind of expecting a blues song. You know, I'm back in the '30s. Edith Keeler was killed. But they didn't go for that, unfortunately.
No. But that would have worked, though. Certainly for me, especially with the part, you know, with the staircase, falling down the stairs would have been.
I've got the went through the guardian of forever, and now I can't get back a blues. But unfortunately, or fortunately, they didn't go in that direction. What did you think of the song, Chris?
What did I like the direction they went in because, you know, this episode is all about Kirk's choice and the fact that he, you know, has romantic feelings for Edith Keeler and he has to make this huge decision that because you're talking here about choosing between, you know, altering your future, everything that you've known is gone, just in order to satisfy your own personal feelings or, you know, doing something for the greater good. And certainly a decision that, you know, a captain has to make often. And that's the crux of this story for me. And so I think that this approach to it really captured the story very well.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, taking a very different kind of story, why don't we flip over and play a little clip from Operation Annihilate.
Annihilate.
Today was a day like any other. It started the same way as every other, till a guy
Well, sorry I couldn't control myself there, Greg. You know how much I love the fact that this episode has an exclamation point at the end of the
yes,
title.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I did not know what they were going to do with this one because basically you've got a story of giant amoeba, space amoebas, right?
Right.
Who like to suck on people's backs. And of course, you do have, it is one of those stories where we do find out a little bit about family. We have Kirk's brother, mm-hmm. who is on this planet, right? And you don't really hear a whole lot about Kirk's family in the original series itself. So there's something there, but it's a very unusual episode.
Yeah.
Especially to think that it's the final episode of the season. And the take on it was really quite unusual. I really love the beginning of the music, though, which sums up the oddity, I think.
It really does, yes. Yeah, I like the piano bits. You know, you don't hear enough piano, but it goes to the diversity of Five Year Mission that they can have a song that's, you know, primarily piano and singing. I don't remember this episode barely at all, but I do enjoy the song. You know, I'm looking forward, definitely, we talked about this having an exclamation mark. I'm really looking forward to hearing Five Year Mission's version of Bride of Chaotica.
When they yeah. So how many years is it going to be? If they go through the original series and then they go through TNG right. and then DS9, I can't wait for the Dominion War album.
Oh, that will be perfect. You know, it'll be a little hard to put a comedic twist on a lot of the Dominion War episodes, but I have faith. I have faith.
I think that they could recycle the arena and just substitute for the Gorn, just substitute the Dominion.
Right.
Or the Vord or the Jem'Hadar, and it'll work.
I'm Benjamin Sisko. I can't even make that work.
Oh gosh. All right. So to be honest, I don't know exactly what to say about this particular track here with Operation Annihilate, other than it's a very unexpected twist. I quite like the song. It's really fun. I like the vocal. I think Mike singing on here, right?
I think so.
It just reminds me of like everyone's at a dance, you know, like in the 60s.
Right.
It's got this big, big buildup to it. And it's a fun track. And I love the beginning. I'll just put the beginning on loop over.
There
over.
You go.
That'd be great. All right. So Year 2 is available on iTunes directly from Five Year Mission, fiveyearmission.net. And I haven't been to the other stores. Greg, I don't know. Do you ever go to like Amazon MP3 stores or anywhere like that?
Not since iTunes removed the DRM. You know, there's not really been any reason to go back to Amazon. But I do understand it's at the major stores now.
Yeah, I understand it's at most of the major MP3 stores, so you can go pick it up there. All right, Greg. Well, Five Year Mission's album may be in all the MP3 stores, but I have something here that's not. I've been listening and don't know how much that I can take. Tell the truth, girl. What about this nasty rumor going round?
Kirk! My junior officer has something he wants to say to you.
I apologize.
Bitch.
All right. I suppose that Claw is apologizing for the rumor that he's been spreading. Apparently, he has teamed up with Simon Pegg to spread as many rumors as possible about the new movie.
Well, if you need to go on an intense physical regimen, I could imagine Trainer Claw would be very, very helpful in getting ready
for the
new movie.
Because apparently we really don't have many new movie rumors this week other than, and it's not even a rumor really, it's just some news that apparently Simon Pegg is getting into shape for the new movie. Now, Greg, do you feel like you're in shape for the new movie yet?
I'm working on it. You know, I've been doing a lot of, been putting my 3D glasses on and then taking them off and then putting them back on and then taking them off. And I think I'm about there. I'm about ready.
Oh, I mean, now Peg's got to get into shape, I understand, you know, because he's probably going to have to be running around engineering, which is going to be set in a bakery this time. Is that right?
It is, yes. You know, that may look like a dough rising station, but no, that's actually a console, you know, that controls the antimatter flow. You know, that may look like a brick oven, but that is actually a plasma coil.
Right. And over on the refrigerator, what looks like a cooking timer is actually the self-destruct sequence countdown.
It is. You know, they used to have, you know, the computer voice counting down, you know, 1 minute to self-destruct, 30 seconds to self-destruct. Now, it's an egg timer. You know, it's a cost-saving move, really.
Right. Well, when you don't have to actually build those props or, you know, hire any voice actors for that, it works out really well.
You know, I'm not actually sure why Simon Pegg needs to get in shape for the for the new movie. I just saw him in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. He's essentially playing the same character again. He even has the same lines. At one point he tells Tom Cruise, "This is exciting." You know, exactly as he does in Star Trek. So I'm not sure how big a difference is.
I like the line where he says that he can steal a grapefruit from that building, which is easy, by the way.
Exactly. Yes, he started going on and on about Admiral Archer's beagle, and I don't think it was germane to the plot.
Maybe he's been reading the Star Trek sequel script too much, and
well, that's the problem. You know,
mixed up a little bit.
You know, JJ gave him the Gross Protocol script and the Khan's Revenge script. That's my working title for Star Trek II, Khan's Revenge. So he was given both of those scripts, and he sort of dropped them. And when he picked them up, you know, the wind blew them away. He had to chase it down. And basically, they've been mixed. So it's a very long script, and they're basically combined. He has all of his lines highlighted, but he's not sure which lines go in which movie.
Oh, gosh. Well, it's just interesting that it seems that the majority of whatever news that we've gotten through the holidays about the movie has come from Simon Pegg for some reason.
Yes.
It's like he's the... Either he has nothing else to talk about, or the studio has decided to leak information through Simon Pegg specifically.
Right.
Because everyone else is busy getting into shape themselves for
right.
the movie. Now, as for other actors getting into shape for the movie, what do you think they need to do? Like, what does Chris Pine need to do to get in shape to play Kirk?
Well, apparently Chris Pine is practicing for his role in Star Trek II by acting opposite young Picard in a spy movie that's coming up. So I figure he's getting some tips from young Picard on how to be a Starfleet captain.
Okay. Yeah, that could be it as well. Is he going to have to shave his head?
He might. That would... What's strange is Chris Pine is actually going to shave his head and then wear a toupee. He said in a recent interview, it would be more... I don't even...
Are we going to see him also in pastel uniforms in this next year?
Yes.
It's going to be weird. Kirk's going to be wearing this, you know, pastel uniform, and he's going to have on a shaved head with a toupee, and he's going to call staff meetings, and then he's going to go back down to the bakery engineering and set the egg timer to self-destruct the ship.
And then he's going to run away.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, someone else. What about, say, Zachary Quinto, Zoe Saldana?
Right. Well, Zachary Quinto has been mind-melding with everything. You know, I saw him. He's got that new movie, Margin Call, where he works at a insurance company. I guess they sell mortgage-backed securities. So he's basically been mind-melding with a lot of computers, a lot of documents, a lot of securities.
Mind-melding with documents.
He's been mind-meld... In a climactic scene, he mind-melds with the Fed, the U.S. Federal Reserve, and manages to turn around the nation's
economy. Yeah, I see. So that's how we're going to solve this whole economic crisis. So I didn't realize that Vulcans actually have like built-in hand scanners.
Right,
that basically,
right.
Like, yeah. They can scan documents.
They were the first tricorders.
So are we going to see some like Xerox product placement in this next movie?
It's very possible. It is.
See, in a week where there are no movie rumors, we just make our own.
Do you have anyone else? Anyone else you want to ask me how they're preparing for Star Trek?
I don't know. I think while we're talking about Zachary Quinto and Zoe Saldana there, I think we should shift gears just slightly here for a minute.
I've been really trying.
Is this from the climactic scene in Star Trek Ongoing 4?
Yes, it is. So I thought that we need to talk about Star Trek Ongoing number 4 a little bit. So
let's get it on.
Oh my goodness. All right. So as we're talking about the movie here, let's talk about the conclusion of the Galileo 7 in the IDW Star Trek Ongoing comics. And two things to talk about here. First of all, how they ended this reimagining of an original series episode, and also the fact that just recently, Mike Johnson, a writer for the Star Trek Ongoing series, confirmed that they are indeed dropping clues about the next movie into the comic series, and that there was a clue to the subplot in issue number 1. But before we get to issue number 1 in these hidden clues, Greg, let's talk a little bit about the Galileo 7 conclusion here. What did you think about this?
Yeah. You know, You know, Chris, we talked about the conclusion of the Where No Man Has Gone Before comic, and I think I liked it a little bit more than you did. I liked how they had improved on many bits of it, made it feel like it had more of a budget. They've done the same thing here. You know, the aliens, there's more of the aliens, and they are, you know, scarier, more realistic as far as they're drawn. But, I mean, we talked about Galileo 7 a month ago, and what we said the heart of the episode was Spock, you know, coming to terms with a desperate situation and learning that there's more than logic and learning that command takes more than just Vulcan, you know, Vulcanness. And I don't feel like Spock learned anything in this comic.
No.
I don't know if we want to jump into spoilers. You can tell me. But the end of the episode is sort of a Deus ex Uhura. And Spock really doesn't have to fix anything. It's sort of fixed for him.
Yeah. Well, I do want to talk about it. So this is a spoiler alert for anyone listening who is planning to read these comics and hasn't read it yet. You may want to go grab it. It won't take you very long to read it. And come back and listen to this little segment here later on. But yeah, so, you know, the first half of this story, Greg, was pretty much straightforward compared to the original, with a few things like having a Yeoman Rand there at this time. But yeah, you know, I don't know. This one for me just didn't work. I did not like the way that they concluded this story. It, like you said, it loses the entire point of the original episode. And I mean, Uhura is going to go and hijack, steal a shuttlecraft to go down to the planet by herself and rescue her lover, Spock, and everyone else.
Right.
I
mean, what was her plan? Know. That they would leave behind, you know, they would leave behind 7 crewmen, but not 8? Or was her plan that they could, you know, she could pick them up and then, you know, bring them back to the ship? And if that was possible, why didn't Kirk just do that? You know, there were specific reasons in the original show why they couldn't just send another shuttlecraft down there.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It's just, apparently, you know, all of the whatever energy from the nebula there that caused the problems for the Galileo shuttlecraft apparently did not have any effect on Uhura's shuttlecraft.
Well, she has the reality distortion field. So that makes perfect sense.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I was reading it and I was thinking, oh, at least Uhura has something more to do.
That's true.
Than just, you know, sitting there pressing buttons until Spock needs a hug, right?
Right.
And she jumps into action. And I think, okay, well, I don't really like this solution to the problem, but at least she's doing something. And then we get to the end, and they get back on board, and then the space Marvin Gaye kicks in, and and Kirk orders them to shared confinement in Spock's quarters.
Well, this goes back to the end of the original Star Trek film. And, you know, I called it a Harry Potter ending, where you're sort of punished, but you're not really punished in any real way. That's sort of what Kirk then does for Spock and Uhura, you know, shared confinement. You know, it's an obvious joke that he's making, but you know, really there is rank and structure here, and there are Starfleet protocols that really are supposed to be followed.
Well, in what way is this even sort of being punished?
Right.
For Spock or Uhura here. I mean, the final frame of the comic is them making out by the windows with the stars behind them, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I was actually quite disappointed in it, because there's already this feeling amongst the fans that the whole Spock Uhura thing is inappropriate. I personally, as I've said on here before, I don't have a problem with Spock and Uhura being an item, you know, having a relationship in this new alternate timeline. That doesn't really bother me. I just want to see Uhura do something more than run around and hug Spock every time something goes wrong. Right. I want to see her have an actual role. Like on Voyager, you have Tom and B'Elanna.
Right.
okay, they have a relationship, and later they are married, but they each have their own roles on the ship, and they play important roles on the ship, and they're not just there to, you know, run around. You know, B'Elanne is the chief engineer. She's not just running to make sure Tom's okay every time the ship shakes. And
get that cheese to sick bay.
Some of my favorite lines. But there's already this feeling, you know, from the fans that all Uhura did in the last movie was to run around and hug Spock. And then to do this in the comic and to say that we're dropping clues to the next movie in the comics, it gives me a little bit of concern that Uhura is going to be relegated to this kind of role in the movies of just Spock's girlfriend.
Yeah, it's the thing of that final panel. It's not even the final panel. It's the final page. It feels like I'm going to invent a word here that I hope will not be the show title. The twilightification of Star Trek. You know, Spock becomes the Robert Pattinson sparkly vampire. And that's not something I'm interested in.
No, because then George Takei will say,
"And it is really, really bad."
Exactly. You know, I know people have problems with the first film, but I felt like they didn't give anybody much to do. You know, I can't complain too much that Uhura wasn't given much to do. But at least, I mean, in this comic, they had Janis Rand flying the shuttle. So if you can have Rand flying the shuttle, surely you could have something for Uhura to do better than just, you know, break orders and then make out with Spock. It's kind of painful.
Absolutely. I definitely hope that that's the case. But yeah, that's just, in the first movie, everyone not having too much to do is fine because they're meeting each other. I'm more concerned about where this is all headed. So
yeah,
I did like the fact that the aliens there were more of them. They looked more threatening, and the shuttle was not being attacked by a single creature like it was in the original series, which was obviously a budgetary thing. I'm sure that the vision was that they were in real danger, but instead there was like this one abominable snowman guy with a giant spear, like hitting the top of the shuttle with the boulder. Really under attack.
I liked how faithful they were to the original when Scotty goes to activate the electrical charge on the shuttle. They spend a good 4 pages on him removing the panel, messing around with it, pushing the button, putting the... No, they don't. It's about half a page.
And I like... No, I like the series of panels where, like, in this one, he's wiggling it up. In the next panel, he's wiggling it down. And the next one, he's wiggling it up. And then the next one, they zoom in on his face.
Speaking of which, I really missed the dramatic zoom out when Kirk says, "Fool, impulse. Bum, bum, bum." In this one, it's much more of a smaller moment. I mean, Galactic Commissioner Timepiece is still there on the bridge. He's not off sulking wherever he was in the episode. And he's full impulse. Yeah, okay, that'll work.
Yeah, all right, whatever. Yeah. You wanted a series of pages where you could flip through really quickly and you'd get the zoom out,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I thought that Galactic Walking Timepiece was overly chatty in the second part of this story.
Yeah. Well, at least he's not saying the same thing every time. You know, he only had one line. He repeats it about 4 times in the show. He at least, I don't know. They had to stay focused on what the original show was. And so he had to be around. But unfortunately, there's not much he can do. You know, it would have been a great thing if he'd been the one manning the shuttlecraft.
Yeah, right.
You know, he had to make this great decision about, okay, it's important that we get the medicine, but I need to make sure that these people are saved. You know, they didn't go in that direction. They pretty much kept his character as it was.
Yeah. I think what it would be that he realizes that Kirk's not going to listen to him. So he goes and steals a shuttlecraft and he's like, "Oh God, I'm just going to go rescue these people and get it over with so we can get over to the new Paris colony."
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right. So that's the conclusion to this. And then we're going to get Operation Annihilate in the next comic, next 2.
Right.
And
I'm looking forward to seeing the high budget amoebas.
Oh yeah. They're going to be meaner looking, I think.
Yeah, certainly.
And they're going to be more of them.
Do you think they'll be able to afford 2 exclamation marks?
Maybe. I think in this one, the amoeba is going to get on Spock's back and Uhura is going to steal a shuttle and fly down to the planet and rip it off of his back.
Nice.
All right. Well, while we're talking about the comics, Greg, what I did want to also talk about today is this news that writer Mike Johnson has confirmed that they have been dropping clues to the next movie storyline into the comics. And he said that there was a clue to the subplot in the first issue of Star Trek Ongoing. And now that that's confirmed, I have a pretty good idea of what I think it is. Now, I was reading about this on TrekMovie.com, and they said that going back and looking through issue number one, nothing really jumped out to them. But there actually is something that jumped out to me. And how about you? What do you think?
Yeah, something jumped out to me. Well, we'll see if it's the same thing.
All right.
I'm pretty sure it was, let's see, now I'm going to have to remember. It's been a while since I read the comic, and so I'm trying to remember what her name was. But the sign, or the doctor who was on board in the original episode.
Right, Daner.
Daner. Yeah. Daner's not there, and she has some sort of past with McCoy. And it's really bizarre that it would be brought up if it wasn't something that was going to lead into a later storyline, or especially the movie.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think. When we talked about number one on here, when it first came out, we mentioned the fact that there's that throwaway line by Dr. McCoy about, actually, who has the line? Does Kirk have the line? And he says, like, wasn't there something between you
right,
guys?
Something like that,
something like that. But there's like a throwaway line that Kirk and Daner, sorry, that was in the original, that McCoy and Daner had a past relationship. And I think at the time we said, maybe they just threw it in, you know, to say, hey, this is an alternate timeline. You know, here's something different. It wasn't Kirk, it was McCoy kind of thing. And but now that that's confirmed and Alice Eve was cast, who, you know, looks like Daner, can make a great Daner. I kind of think that might be it. That and he did say it's a clue to the subplot, not the main plot.
Right.
So it's maybe not a retelling of Where No Man Has Gone Before with Garry Mitchell and all that stuff. Just the fact that Daner was not on the ship in the alternate universe Where No Man Has Gone Before, she could appear now. She could come aboard the ship now. And then she and McCoy had some kind of past thing going on.
Right.
I think that that's the clue to the subplot of the sequel.
I think it's very possible. You know, she's going to be able to pick up on Khan's latent ESP ability. And then have a mind-to-mind battle with him in the climactic end.
You're still certain that it's Khan, right?
I'm sort of certain. Now, let's see. Now, he said there was also a clue in issue four. I don't know if anything jumped out to me like in issue one. It was interesting that Rand is here. Rand has more to do than just bringing people tea. You know, she's actually piloting the shuttle. It would be interesting to see if they do have more of an effort to have more female crew members on the Enterprise. It was very much a man movie. And aside from Uhura being there and Kirk's green girlfriend at the very beginning, there were not many female Starfleet officers. So it would be great if Nurse Chapel were in it, Rand, Uhura, Daner, much more of a, you know, co-ed movie.
Yeah, I do think the fact that Rand is in number three and four here, Galileo 7, is a sign that she's probably going to be in the movie. Again, I don't know for sure, but it would certainly make sense. She was a very popular character, even though she was only in, what, like 6 or 7 episodes of the original series?
If that,
before she was written off. Yeah, only a small number there. I think she'll be back. But I don't think she'll be playing any kind of huge major role other than maybe she's going to fly a shuttle somewhere.
Well, it'd be great if at least, you know, she could be Sulu's backup when he has to get up to, you know, do an away mission. She can be the one rather than just random ensign. She can come in and sit down and start piloting the ship.
Yeah. Yeah. Random ensign was like the classic TNG move,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
It's like, there's like no pilot for the Enterprise D.
Yeah.
It's just whoever. Hey, you over there on the bridge. Well, I don't know why you're on the bridge, but it doesn't look like you're doing anything.
Right.
Could you come fly the ship for a little while?
There's like people in the corner playing checkers. And whenever Data just decides to get up and go somewhere, you know, sulk in his room,
run over.
Someone else just like, oh, sorry, hold the game. I've got to go.
Yeah, it's like there's a whole complement of crew members on the Enterprise D for every purpose. It's like they were talking about on Dork Trek. There's like the designated fencing officer that just hangs around for when Picard wants to fence, and then this guy runs in to fence with him.
Right. Unfortunately, we never see Troy's backup, because as ineffective as Troy was in seasons 1 and 2, you have no idea how terrible the backup counselor is. Captain, I'm not sure what he's feeling. I mean, I know he's pointing a phaser at you.
Yeah.
It might be sarcasm. Shoot. I studied for this.
Yeah. Captain, I think he's being sarcastic. Gosh, all right. And somehow we managed to... are they doing like a Next Generation ongoing comic series?
That would be fantastic. I'd love to see that. I've seen no evidence of it as of yet.
All right. Well, those are the things, I guess, that jump out to me. Is there anything else that you've encountered in these first 4 issues that you think are clues to the plot of the next movie? Legitimately clues?
Legitimately clues. I'm not sure. I think... Is it just me, or did fewer people die in this version of Galileo 7? I feel like not many people survived in the original, but I'm not remembering. Maybe it's the same number of people.
Did two people die in the original, I think?
Yeah, and in this one, it's only one, right? Just Latimer dies.
I think so. I think just Latimer, in this one.
I don't know if that's indicative of anything. I did like the scene where Boma is going to go sacrifice himself, and then Spock decides. They sort of nailed in on that as being the big dramatic thing, is who's going to sacrifice themselves so they can break orbit. So it's not a bad place to go. It's just not quite where the original show did.
Right.
But I don't know if...
And it wasn't... In the original show, like we talked about earlier, Spock kind of grew in this episode and realized that logic is not the end-all of solution to everything. But here, that didn't happen, because him deciding to sacrifice himself is, I think, a logical conclusion that he came to. It's what you would expect from a Vulcan or from Spock. So he didn't grow like he did in the original episode.
I mean, to play devil's advocate again, it's possible that was their intention, that they wanted to say, you know, this isn't still very early for Spock. He's not ready to make that sort of, you know, character change, life change. And maybe they want to save the movies for really big changes like that. It's just weird that they would pick a show like Galileo 7 that was about Spock's character arc.
It's about him.
And make it not be about his character arc.
Right. Unless they have another reason because of something else in there that is a clue to.
Right. Which is possible.
It ties in. Yeah.
But I didn't notice anything else in particular that could be. So.
All right. Well, we'll see where it goes. Operation Annihilate will be coming out in, was it towards the end of this month, I guess, and then February?
Yeah, it'll be the last week of January will be issue 5. So, well, we'll talk about that in another month.
When the studio set out to start the fourth spinoff of the original Star Trek series, they wanted to take things in a new direction, and that included not only sending the ship to the other side of the galaxy, but also trying to create some conflict within the series. And to do that, they created the Maquis. And today we'll talk about the Maquis a little bit and the episode Worst Case Scenario. And of course, Greg is with me. And also with us today is one of the few owners in the world of an actual Star Trek communicator phone.
Dramatic pause.
Michael Fisher.
Thank you. Yeah, how are you doing, Chris? Good to see you.
All right. Thanks for joining us again, Michael. How's your new year going?
Well, it's actually going very well. I had a very busy day of cleaning up the debris from the celebration of the end of the last year. So.
All right. And, now, you didn't stumble across any like hidden Holo novels where someone attempts to take over your house, did you?
Thankfully, not yet this year, and that's why I have high hopes for 2012. Yeah, no Martha Hackett stumbling out of my closet with a gun. No.
Yeah, you never want to see
what
that.
Is it with Martha Hackett on this show?
She just can't stay away. I know.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, so why don't we talk a little bit about the Maquis and Voyager and worst case scenario? And of course, Star Trek, through the Next Generation anyway, there really was no conflict internally in the show. You know, the crew, everyone loves everybody. People take bubble baths together and, you know, hang out and tend forward and have chocolate fudge sundaes. And it's just a real happy place, right. You know, amongst everybody. So, of course, DS9 right. changed that a little bit. But when they set out to make Voyager, they had to try to create some internal conflict within the crew. And so we have the Maquis showing up.
Yeah, I feel like it's another good Big Bang Theory title, The Roddenberry Loophole, as the writers are always looking for ways to get around the Great Bird of the Sky's restrictions. You know, there can't be conflict. Well, let's make them not be Starfleet officers. It's a good way to go, and it made a lot of sense in Caretaker. I don't feel like, I think we talked about on the show before, that they didn't really take advantage of it. And this episode, I think we're well into the show at this point, and it's sort of a throwback to, you know, early times in the series. You know, it's very much not a situation that they were dealing with at that point. They'd moved way past the Maquis, Starfleet being any sort of a difference. And then the last time that was really played up was Learning Curve at the very end of season one, where we sort of had a few Maquis crew members who were still not quite find themselves part of the crew. But at the end of it, you know, Tuvok learned to bend the rules. I think I can learn to follow them. Right. So it's very much just summed it all up and said, let's throw out that
a touching
plot
moment there, right?
When we were talking about before the podcast, talking about the podcast, and we discussed, we're talking about this section on Voyager and how the Maquis and Starfleet crews got along and didn't get along. I wanted to say that this is going to be a very short section because it was not explored. I mean, you guys are absolutely correct. And this is what's always talked about as one of the fundamental weaknesses of Voyager. To me, this worst case scenario, the episode depicted a possible Star Trek Voyager that I would have preferred to see. Mm. I mean, if they had spent time on an arc like this, instead of, you know, in later seasons, you know, if we could take the time in later seasons when they did Nazi aliens take over the holodecks with Nazi Hiroshima or whoever the hell they were, if we could take that time and instead put it into a series like this where you have just endless possibility for character development and right. wonderful conflict between these people that we actually care about, then that would have been just great. But no, instead we have a bottle show. So
I mean, imagine you take the first 10 or 15 minutes of this episode and show it to someone who's just starting to watch Voyager. Yeah. You know, pretend this is, you know, episode 7 or 8
yes.
of the show.
Yeah.
They are going to get so excited.
Sucked in.
Like, there's going to be a mutiny. It's going to be Chakotay versus Tuvok versus, you know, you're going to have, B'Elanna shooting Paris. You know, that's exciting.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, you know, you're at the end of season 3. You know that's not what's going on. You especially know that B'Elanna is not an ensign, and
one of the first tip-offs.
Right,
he calls her ensign.
Right, but as far as if this had been a real episode and not a holo novel, as you're saying, Mike, that would be so much more interesting. And
absolutely,
I'll talk about Battlestar Galactica in a minute, but so much more of a thing that a better show would go in.
And Greg can safely talk about Battlestar Galactica since it has already finished and there's no danger of it being canceled.
Spoiler alert.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, I was watching this episode and I was trying to think about... I was trying to think back to when I saw it the very first time. And did I buy into it at all at the very beginning that there was any kind of mutiny going on? And I can't remember anymore how I felt when it first came on.
Right.
They do a good job of playing it up at the beginning to making it seem like it's legitimately happening. You know, there aren't any initial clues that this is a holodeck program because B'Elanna wearing gold I guess if you look at her collar, maybe she's got on a, you know, ensign pip. Oh, I don't remember.
Notice. Did they change her collar device there?
Well, it's the field commission, so you can't tell in standard def the difference between the field commission ranks anyway. Yeah.
It's just the little stripes on there, the chevrons.
It's only when it's Paris that he's only got one pip instead of the two.
Yeah. Oh, right. So there's some, you know, like that. So it seems pretty legitimate at that point. But of course, in reality, if you've watched this first three seasons, this is the next to last episode of the third season. The next episode is Scorpion, where the show changes directions and Seven of Nine first makes her appearance.
The show grows the catsuit.
I was going to say the show dons the catsuit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think dons the catsuit is better than growing the catsuit.
Although growing the catsuit is just terrifying.
You never know what Borg might be able to do.
Right.
So if you grow a catsuit, can you then shed a catsuit later? Or that's for a totally different.
Well, I was going to say Voyager Trek of M After Dark.
Yeah, right. So, but if you watch the series up to this point, I mean, you kind of know that the whole Maquis thing was abandoned long ago. So, Chakotay's not going to suddenly decide to take over the ship. But I did think they did a pretty good job of playing it up there at the very like the first 10 minutes until Paris walks in and says, "What's going on here?"
And he has a great line. I'm sorry. B'Elanna's all pissed off that Paris has interrupted her program. And he comes in and he says, "It's not like I walked in on you dancing the rumba with a naked Bolian."
Yeah, right.
I think is one of the funniest lines that Voyager's ever come up with. Yeah. That mental image is
I wonder if
hilarious.
That's on the really is that good, on the yeah. DVD in the deleted scenes? Do they have B'Elanna dancing
do they ever
naked
shoot
Bolian?
Right.
I think I'll check that out.
Well, that's what, you know... Back when they were doing teasers with Janeway doing the Holo novel, no, maybe they could have started some of the episodes with the other members of the crew and what they were doing. So, you know, random terrible.
I thought
things.
You were going to say there was the teaser where Janeway is dancing the rumba naked with Leonardo da Vinci.
Oh, with John Rhys Davies? Yeah. Oh,
would have made as much sense as what they went with.
Yeah, you're right.
So, well, anyway, like Michael, like you said, this Holo novel shows a Voyager that could have been, right? So I want to talk a little bit about that. But before we do that, let's kind of rewind a little bit to the whole concept of the Maquis and what they were trying to set up in the first place. And so... you said earlier that, like, the Roddenberry loophole, Greg, to let's make them not Starfleet officers so that we can create internal conflict. And that's something that Deep Space Nine did really well by having Major Kira in particular, who, you know, I was watching the Maquis, actually, the two-part episode of DS9 that set up Voyager, that set up the idea of the Maquis. And that is... well into the second season. It's actually towards the end. I think it's the 20th, 21st episodes of season two. And Kira and Sisko still have this kind of tug-of-war relationship with each other at that point, heading almost into season three, where like they kind of get along and they kind of don't. And Kira still thinks that a lot of Sisko's Starfleet thinking is naive. But there, Kira is clearly not a member of Starfleet. So they did create characters who were separate from the Starfleet crew to create conflict. And it's conflict that lasted. And they kept the conflict going on some levels throughout all of DS9, really. Whereas here, they kind of, you know, halfway did it. Okay, so we have people who, they're not Starfleet technically, but they kind of are. You know, Chakotay was... an instructor at the academy, right? And he had a Starfleet commission, and B'Elanna was studied at the academy, and Paris was actually an officer who turned bad. And so they kind of like, they didn't want to go all the way. I think that's the problem with Voyager in general when it comes to the Maquis, that the writers, they just couldn't commit to going all the way with this conflict. And that's why it was so quickly abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, as Ben Stiller says in Tropic Thunder, you never go full Maquis. No, but I think this is part of the problem that Robert Beltran had with his character, is that they neutered him so early on.
Yeah,
they they still wanted to have a Star Trek show where they wanted to have that Janeway, Chakotay, Tuvok thing, where you have this really strong command structure, and that killed the conflict that I think some of the other producers wanted to have. They never let Chakotay really stand up to Janeway. You know, the few times he did stand up to her, Janeway just did whatever she wanted anyway. Mm-hmm. Chakotay never did what he wanted to do, I feel like. He never stood up and said, you know what, we're going to do it this way, not that way. And if you don't like it, we're going to have actual conflict. They just made him, you know, what's the line about the Kazon? The Kazon or the Klingon?
Junkyard Klingons.
Yeah. Junkyard. Right. Yeah. Chakotay's sort of a junkyard Riker.
Yeah. Never thought about that, but yeah, it's true.
I read it. I think in one of the companions, they say that Chakotay had a really bad case of first officer disease, is what the writers termed it. And yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult character to write because you're in this quasi military command structure where like the XO, you know, has to be able to offer alternatives, and that's his job, is to sit there and say, no, why don't we do it this way? But ultimately, the captain gives the order, and the captain's going to be right all the time. So how do you write for that? I mean, that's got to be very difficult.
Well, that's one thing I love about – I'm going to now talk about Battlestar Galactica since I've watched about 10 hours of it in the past 24 hours.
You're getting ready for our Battlestar Galactica podcast, right? It's.
I am. We're going to record that one after our Star Wars podcast.
Yeah, yep.
Guys, I got to be in on all that. All these fictitious podcasts.
Yeah, these are
our
secret
podcasts.
We just record them for our own pleasure.
On our fictitious podcast.
Awesome. All right, good.
But one thing I liked about Battlestar was that the XO,
Colonel Ty,
he doesn't actually go to Adama with everything he wants to do. Very often, he'll just make a decision and do it. And it's a big part of the miniseries when he orders, there's a fire and he orders that a certain section get shut off and then vented. He didn't go to Adama and recommend it. He just
there are no
ordered
staff
it.
Meetings in and Battlestar then, Galactica for things like that, right?
Staff meeting.
Yes. I can't imagine Edward James Olmos. Staff meeting. If he did have a staff meeting, he'd be eating noodles through the whole thing.
You gotta have a fracking conference every time you want to do something.
Exactly. Anyway, so then when Chief Tyrell comes and complains to Adama, you know, I had 47 men out there. You know, Adama basically just backed Ty up and said, you know, he's the XO. He made that decision. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to see Chakotay make a decision and then Janeway say, you know what, maybe I wouldn't have made it that decision. Maybe I would have. But the fact is, he's the XO. He makes those sorts of decisions, and you'd better follow him. Janeway didn't do that. It was Janeway's rule all the time. And even if she left the ship for a moment, it was, here's what I want you to do while I'm gone. You better follow.
Because even with Riker, right. I mean, Riker made a lot more unilateral decisions, I think. And Picard was fine with it. Picard was like, well, Riker's second in command. You know, if something needs to be done, you make the decision. I'm going to be in here reading Moby Dick and drinking Earl Grey tea, right?
Right.
We do get a little bit of it like watered down in this episode, in worst case scenario, where holographic Harry Kim is like, you sure you want to take the transporters offline, Chakotay, while the captain's gone? And then Tuvok's like, Chakotay just told you to do something and you do it.
Yeah.
And that's all we get. I mean, that, you know, in this, of course, it's a holographic situation. It's
not even real.
It's not, exactly. It's not even real. Right. But that's even, and if it were real, it wouldn't even be notable because it's just kind of a throwaway way to absorb 20 seconds.
I think one of the closest cases that we have of Chakotay really standing up to Janeway was in Year of Hell, right? Where maybe in the first part where he really, really disagrees with her. And then he goes and, you know, and he does his own thing on the time ship. We did a whole show about that, so we won't talk about it here. But there are these moments where he's kind
Scorpion
of stood up
too.
To her, but he's never truly stood up to her to realize the kind of conflict that the Maquis were supposed to. And then what you see were in worst case scenario here, where he really just takes charge.
Yeah, it felt like, wow, finally he's getting to do something. Like I'd love to hear what Beltran had to say about this episode. I know for the most part he didn't like his character, but I imagine he would have enjoyed this episode, even realizing it wasn't real. But saying, look, I get to break out of my shell for once. I get to actually make some decisions, lead some people like I haven't since the first 5 minutes of Caretaker.
Mm. Probably. I have such a... Robert Beltran has really, really legitimate complaints about the writing of Voyager. And I, as an actor, I know that that is so frustrating. It's a very frustrating situation to be in. He just handles it with such an absolute lack of grace in all of his internet.
Right.
Like, and I can't ever tell if he's actually, if he's joking or if it's like, if it's this one really long kind of sarcastic joke that he's playing on everybody when he bitches about working with Tim Russ and so forth.
Some like, kind of like, long con that's going to play out, you know, like 20 years from now.
Yeah. When he's got like a big white beard and he's smiling and doing Folgers commercials. And so, I'm just
you guys
a nice
didn't
guy.
Realize that whole time I loved being on Voyager. Wow. You people.
I really had you going there.
Right.
All right. So maybe we could have a contest between him and Garrett Wong to see who...
who has the sourest grapes.
Yeah. Oh, but
right.
I don't know. So this one question I have here is, I guess, Michael, you already answered this, but I don't know if I would have wanted Voyager to be a 7-year series of conflict between Janeway and Chakotay or the Starfleet officers and the Maquis on board, but certainly I would have wanted it to go for, you know, a couple of seasons or so as they kind of get used to each other. And instead, we didn't. I started rewatching season one to kind of prepare for talking about this because I wanted to go back and see how long the conflict lasted. What are the moments of conflict that we got, especially moments that didn't involve Seska? And because the real, you know, Seska is one thing, but the real point of conflict is how does Chakotay, how does B'Elanna fit into the crew? Because they're the main Maquis members who, you know, become part of the actual senior staff and have to get along with everybody. And as I'm watching it, you know, Greg said, tell me some good episodes that I should go watch. And right. I was kind of early on in it. And I was like, well, Caretaker, obviously you've got some because they're setting it up. You know, Parallax, there's a little bit of it. Chakotay's lobbying for B'Elanna to be the chief engineer.
For B'Elanna's chief engineer over Lieutenant Carey, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that
yeah.
was good.
So that was kind of going on. And at that point, it kind of made some sense. But then you get into the next few, you know, Time and Again, and the Phage, and there's like really none of this is there. It's all about, it's kind of very typical Star Trek stories that you're starting to get. And they're a Starfleet crew
already.
And they're facing these. And you're already like, you're in the third episode. It's like, where's the conflict? And, you know, it does kind of through season one, they have the moments where they kind of have this conflict going, but I don't feel like it ever really was at a level that it should have been. You never had the Kira doesn't want the Federation here kind of conflict that she had with Sisko. You even in the end of the second season of DS9, you've got Odo saying, let me do my job. You know, I can't work under all these Starfleet regulations. You really don't get that kind of thing. And did you want to see it
go
longer?
The thing in the thing in Learning Curve that leads them to have this crash course is somebody replaced a bio gel pack without asking permission.
Oh, gosh, don't do that.
He showed too much initiative.
Right.
Wow, right. That's
it's like
conflict.
Someone changed the toilet paper was out, and someone put a new roll on, and they didn't ask Tuvok if it was okay.
Why didn't you check with B'Elanna before changing that roll?
Right.
Oh gosh, now that's some real conflict we've got going right there.
Yeah,
you make a really good.
The cheese had more conflict.
The cheese to sick bay. You make a really good point, Christopher, drawing the parallel here between. The DS9 approach and the Voyager approach, because, you know, you're right. I mean, it took Kira like 2.5 or 3 seasons to actually warm up to the point where she's, you know, realizes the necessity and the advantage
and warm
of having
up.
The
it doesn't mean
there.
That she's then like, you know, buddy-buddy
like,
with Sisko
like
about everything, you know.
Right, right.
She never really fully accepts what's going on. She always, always something tugging with her.
So there's an undercurrent And it's crafted really kind of elegantly and gracefully. And you're right. And in Voyager, after about the third or fourth episode, this whole bunch of potential is swept under the rug. And, I think it's one of the many reasons that people, you know, I don't think it's fair to say Voyager is a worse show, really. It's just a very different kind of entertainment that harkens back to some of the original series at its less good moments.
Yeah.
If I can be, you know.
My favorite series is Deep Space Nine. But as far as just like individual episodes go, if I'm just going to watch a single episode, I think there are more individual Voyager episodes that I might sit down and watch than individual Deep Space Nine episodes. Though I like the DS9 series much better. I think the problem is that DS9, I mean, Voyager has its moments. Voyager has some very good single stories. But what pulls at me all the time when it comes to Voyager is that I just feel like it's a series full of missed opportunities creatively. And the Maquis are the start of that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it doesn't even have to be with Chakotay and B'Elanna. You know, why couldn't we just have some Maquis crew members who want to mutiny or, you know, steal a shuttle or something? You know, maybe we could have an episode where they try to steal Neelix's ship and fly off and do something.
We have the guy, was it Suter or was it someone else who was like feeding information to the Kazon at one point, you know, covertly.
Oh, it was was that Jonas? I don't think it was Suter.
No, Jonas is that's in worst case scenario. Maybe it is in that case as well. I don't remember now exactly who was doing it, but we have Maquis crew member.
Yeah, I thought it was
feeding
him.
Details to the Kazon. We have those kind of moments, but the problem is that they're very like secretive. They're very like this one person is going to try to undermine something. And that's Seska's character is like that as well. Whereas what you want is you want more of this actual discord amongst the crew that adds to they already have a struggle on their hands of having to get back from the Delta Quadrant. They've got to go 70,000 light years to get home. That's tough enough for the crew there. And then you want to have some more discord and conflict amongst the crew to heighten the drama and to make that whole journey more interesting, because the show, and Chakotay says it greatly in this episode where he gets all the junior officers in to the holding area and he tells them, you know, that we're not going to be bound by all of these Starfleet regulations, and we're not going to stop and investigate every little anomaly that we find that looks interesting. You know, we're supposed to be going home, and instead and that's what Voyager kind of devolved into, was like, oh, there's a blue star we need to go check out and see what's happening there because, oh, the solar flare looks cool.
Right.
It's like, no, you need to go home. Right. I mean, you're never, ever going to get there if you stop and investigate every little thing.
It's funny. It is an instance of Voyager talking about itself, which is wonderful.
Yes,
like in Caretaker, you had Janeway say, essentially at the end of the episode, yes, we're far away from home. Yes, our primary mission is to get home. But essentially, we're still Star Trek. We're still going to explore stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And then in this episode, you have Chakotay saying what a lot of the fans are saying, like, don't stop at everything. Like, we want to see you get home. Right. We want to see this struggle. And you're right about the conflict, because it's like, yes, a long trip home, being 70 years away from home, will bring disparate groups of people together, but not immediately, not overnight. And you have people, the Maquis were effectively, they individually had a lot of different motivations, but some of them were terrorists, you know, to achieve their ends. And then you have them thrown into a uniform of an organization that they fundamentally detest at some level, you know, some of them, you know, for throwing them out of their homes. So how do you not explore that over 7 years of a drama? How do you not do that? You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that gets us into what I was going to talk about Battlestar a little bit. But one thing is, you know, you've got 7 years. Why not spend those 7 years playing this out, not just getting past it after 10 episodes? Right. But you look at something like the character of Boomer on Battlestar. There are various ones, but I'll go with the one who's on the ship, who's in love with Chief Tyrell, who realizes, you know, that she's a Cylon and really has to deal with that and has to deal with, you know, where do her motives lie? Because she has these memories of being a colonial, but she also has these feelings of being a Cylon and wanting to do Cylon-y things. Why couldn't we have a character like that who, it's a Maquis, but this person has real deep-seated hatred for Starfleet. And it's not like they're constantly being, you know, not constantly butting heads with Janeway or anything, just kind of looking for an opportunity to mess things up, to really hurt Starfleet. Just because, you know, as you say, some of them really are terrorists. You know, terrorists with a heart of gold, some of them, but it's still, yeah. They're people who are dangerous. Well, and that really should be dealt with, you know, with a major character.
I think this is part of the problem of the whole setup of the series and the writers not wanting to actually go all the way. Because in Deep Space Nine, in the Maquis, like you said, Michael, they've been... I guess in a way they've been thrown out of their homes, but there were the planets and there was the treaty between the Federation and the Cardassians, and some of the Cardassian colonies ended up on the Federation side, and some of the Federation colonies ended up on the Cardassian side, and the Maquis, the people who lived there, they weren't all Maquis. The Maquis were the group of them who decided to become militant. But that's the thing there too. Like the Bajorans and Kira, they were terrorists. They had a militant group fighting against the Cardassians. In this case, some of these colonists formed a militant group called the Maquis to fight against the Cardassians. And also they were in a way against the Federation because they felt betrayed. Like the Federation just kind of abandoned them there, right? But so these people on Deep Space Nine, the Maquis, were not Starfleet officers. They weren't people who, you know, had dropped out of the academy or so forth. They were people who lived their lives on these planets. And like there was one person who, the person who blew up the Cardassian freighter, had spent 20 years, you know, cultivating his farmland and all in this world. And then he felt like he had to fight back because he was being forced to leave his land. And so those people were like terrorists, and they have a legitimate conflict with Starfleet and the Federation, but the people that we got on Voyager weren't those people. What we got on Voyager were a former Starfleet officer in Chakotay, a former Starfleet officer in Paris, a former Academy cadet in Belana. We didn't get these people. And then, of course, Tuvok, who is at the beginning of the episode blended in with the Maquis, is actually Janeway's science officer. We didn't get the real Maquis. I feel like we didn't get the real Maquis. The real Maquis were there on DS9 fighting the Cardassians. And what we got on Voyager were not the real Maquis. They were just some Maquis who Janeway had been sent to capture for some reason. And so the conflict wasn't there.
Right. And the story you were describing just then of the Maquis from the DS9 episode... The farmer who has lost his land over 20 years. I was listening to you tell that 15-second story, and I was instantly more captivated by that and compelled by it than anything that has happened in Voyager on that level, on that character level, right, with what we're talking about. And you're absolutely right. I think it was a half measure, and yeah.
So one thing I wanted to mention was something that Michael brought up briefly earlier, which was how... just how this show really is a comment on the writing process and the Star Trek writing process in general. You know, it is an interesting thing, I imagine, being in the Star Trek writer's room, because there's so many voices, there's so many opinions, that it's hard, I can imagine, to get anything actually written. And that sort of comes out in the scene where, who is it? It's Paris and Tuvok are trying to actually write the program, and other people keep coming in with their suggestions. And I think B'Elanna suggests a love story between the chief engineer and the con officer, which that's ridiculous. Oh, Tom, that would never happen.
Yeah, Tom suggested, and she says, oh, that's realistic.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> Right, but the joke I was making before the show is that the Paris and Tuvok's interaction is very much like when Ronald D. Moore joined the Voyager writing staff. I think that was the next year, but it kind of perfectly presages it, where... you know, you have somebody who has all these ideas, and then someone just says, no, that's not how we do it on this ship.
Right. Mm-hmm. It is. Like Michael said earlier, Chakotay's speech to the junior officers was like the show talking about itself in that respect, that we're going to stop and we're going to explore everything and we're not actually going to worry about our real need, which is getting home. And then, like you say here, this is, again, the show talking about itself in Star Trek in general, I guess, of what is the writer's room like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it, in that case, I really love this episode, totally separate from the Maquis thing, in just that it is so self-aware. You know, it almost breaks the fourth wall in that it is so much commenting on itself and having little in-jokes. You know, I think Memory Alpha might take it a little bit far where it says where the in-jokes are, but there are definitely in-jokes in this. And it is very much a comment on it. And I definitely see them aware of some of the problems with the show. And maybe this episode was in a way they were sort of saying, you know what, we kind of screwed up the whole Maquis thing. You know, maybe we need to examine that and just have a comment on it in the show before we move on to this sort of next phase. Because, I mean, once the Borg really become a major part of the show, they're certainly not ever going back to that Maquis thing.
No, you don't need...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And you could have naturally had that conflict go up to that point. You could have had the conflict between the Maquis and the Starfleet officers up until the Borg threat came around. And then the Borg could have been the thing that made them realize that, hey, if we're going to survive this, we've really all have to band together and have to work together here. That would have made sense to me. I mean, true. I would have been fine. I would have been fine with that if for the final four seasons, there was not that internal conflict because there was a new threat. That would have worked.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I guess my other comment about the show itself was going to be, have you guys seen the film Adaptation by Charlie Kaufman?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know how it's a very good film up until the end when it becomes extremely ridiculous, but it's sort of presaged by Charlie Kaufman's character in the film being told, you know, you need something exciting to happen at the end, that, you know, there needs to be a car chase and a love story and all this stuff, or else people just aren't going to care. So then the film itself sort of goes off the rails at the end. So I feel like something was kind of happening like that here, where they had this like really good episode, but in some level you can't just have an episode where they're commenting on themselves. You do kind of need a threat for people to deal with, which is where Seska shows up. Seska from the past, Martha Hackett, who, you know, Martha Hackett is well loved by friends of the show, Tristan and Brian Finifter. As she, I don't know. Do you guys like Martha Hackett? What did you think of her showing up at the last minute and really wrecking things for everybody?
Personally, I find Martha Hackett's performances to be very, very good. I like her as an actress. I don't like the character, and you're not supposed to like the character very much, but, you know, they just bring her back so damn often. Yeah. It's like any time Voyager needs to, like, go back and look at itself, and, like, what, she comes back again, even. Like, we thought she was dead.
Right.
And then she comes back here, and then she comes back, what, like, three seasons later and shattered?
Right.
When Voyager's having its retrospective look back at itself, and it's like, oh, I bet you Seska's, there she is, you know.
Well, yeah, Seska's Voyager's yard.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I don't know. I don't have any problem with Martha Hackett personally. I didn't mind Seska in the beginning of the series. Very, you know, she was fine there. I felt like maybe the whole, you know, she's a Cardassian. She has like a baby with Chakotay and goes live with Kazon. Yeah. So it was kind of getting a little much, and I was kind of glad to see her leave the show at that point. But then, having her show up here is fine, and it's probably necessary. That's the point where you really truly know that, hey, something is, this is not real, because here's Seska, you know, at the end of season three. I didn't like here personally is the whole holodeck malfunction thing going on again. You know, it's the old going back to the Next Generation. Every time you need to create a problem for the crew to solve, you have a holodeck malfunction. I mean, the holodeck, it must have a warning label in the hallway outside can you think what technology, Microsoft Windows, I don't know, does it run on Windows? What is less reliable than the holodeck? What breaks down more often than the holodeck?
And it's really too bad they didn't have Wesley on board Voyager, because he really would have had this fixed in a jiffy.
You know, only if he had the right goggles in that maintenance locker outside to look at the circuits real close, you know, with his soldering gun and his 1980s magnifying glass.
Oh, you know, it's always... I was enjoying the episode. It's kind of fun. It's like this... When they all get into... There was the scene in the conference room where everyone's admitting that they've been running the program. You know, like even Neelix, like shyly raises his hand and is running the program. It's kind of fun. You know, they're like all into this what if scenario and they're all going in to play it and see. Greg, I think you said on Twitter that this is the blatant product placement, although it would be product placement via time warp here of Star Trek Online, where they're all going in and they're playing an episode of Star Trek Online, right? But it's kind of fun, you know, to watch them do this. And I would have been just fine if the whole episode had been them looking back at what might have been. And it's just that kind of retrospect moment. It's kind of like a better Shades of Grey in a way. It's like a looking back at what happened in the past or, you know, maybe what could have happened. Right. But
it would have been a good, like, episode 100. You know, a lot of shows do very reflective, jokey episode 100.
Well, Voyager kind of did a reflective episode for episode 100 because that was timeless with the ice planet. And, you know, that ice was really very reflective. That
awesome establishing shot.
Sorry about that. But I don't know. Just
get that cheese to sick
bed. That's right.
Bam.
Bad cheese. But the holodeck part here, the malfunction part, and Seska coming back, I could have done without it. So that's my thing about Seska in this episode.
Not only is it a holodeck malfunction episode, but it is, you know, where typically only the inhabitants of the holodeck are in danger.
The inhabitants
of the holodeck.
But it's
a holodeck malfunction episode.
The holodeckians,
well, you know,
right?
Well, the holodeckites. But it is an episode where, you know, the supervillain, Seska, has programmed the holodeck failure such that it's tied into the holographic Voyager's self-destruct system, which will destroy the hologrid. It is very obviously an episode. I mean, this is, as a writer, you know, you look at it and you're like, yes, this is what I want to do. And you're actually going to let me write this ridiculous element of the story. Like the holodeck, like when holographic Voyager explodes, the holodeck explodes.
Right.
What? And we also get a very interesting new functionality of the phaser that we learn about.
Oh, the what?
Yeah, it can just vaporize you all of a sudden.
Like, if phasers, not only can phasers overload and explode, which is cool, and they've been able to do that forever, but now Voyager has said that you can set a phaser with, like, one tap of a button, which is what Tuvok does. You can set a phaser to fire backwards into your own chest, if you want, which is called, you know, a phaser malfunction,
well,
right?
Well, this is the first time since, like, the original series movies we've seen somebody vaporized by a phaser.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I thought was pretty cool, but I'd never seen it,
I'm not sure they'd get vaporized.
Janeway
though,
does. Well, it's all holographic though.
Well, it's holographic vaporization. But
sure, no. I get that. But I mean, you don't see her body fall. You see her fall out of frame, and then you hear the clunk of something hitting the deck. So
there
maybe
is
that's
one
her
scene where Seska shoots Janeway, and she like disintegrates, like in red. Her whole body just like disintegrates and vaporizes.
Is pretty,
yeah,
pretty
and
awesome
then
shot.
And then Chakotay says, like, "Oh, Seska, you're quite a woman," and then they make out, and
and then they make out, which is hilarious. Yeah.
But actually, although we've never seen this press a button and fire the phaser backwards into your chest, the feature has been used before in the Galileo 7 because Scotty had to use that firing backwards feature to power the shuttlecraft so they could regain orbit.
There you go.
That's good. All right, excellent.
But also, the other thing about the phasers here is that they, you know, they always run in and they're like shooting point blank at objects with the phaser rifles. But here Seska goes in to I don't know, was that the galley maybe? And she says, "This phaser is set for wide beam, and I can knock you all out with one shot."
Like,
we've never seen that I can remember anyone use it. Because why wouldn't they use wide beam when the Borg assimilated the Enterprise E or something?
I'll tell you, they use wide beam phasers in the episode of DS9 where Odo is doing the drill. They're
becoming things.
And so they use the wide beam to scan the rooms, but it would come in use, you know, a lot more than they actually use it. It's like they forget it would, anytime it would make sense, but it would kind of make the episode more difficult. Like you have to like shoot really close at somebody and you miss. They forget that the wide beam is an option, but it is something they've actually done before.
Yeah, the original series had an instance of wide beam, which I always forget about, where Sulu has to warm up some rocks on a frozen planet or something, and he shoots this Type 2 at the rock, and instead of one beam, it's like they composited three beams in, and I haven't seen the remastered version of that episode, but I want to see what they did with it. It's probably the same thing, but
what's great about Sulu in the remastered is instead of holding a sword in the Naked Time or the Naked Now, he actually has a lightsaber.
Yes, right. Yes, yes, yes. because they don't use wide beams or anything like that in this episode, we have kind of these rare instances of phasers just grazing somebody.
Yeah,
right. Like I think Tom gets shot in the forearm.
Yeah,
right.
And Harry ducks underneath the phaser one time. He's like so quick.
Oh, yeah,
he ducks.
Fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Paris getting shot, how great was the evil doctor that Seska created?
Awesome.
You know Bob Picardo loved the moments where he was able to just go all evil. You know, inject someone with salt using the hypo spray. That's pretty awesome.
So nasty. Yeah. So,
nitric acid. It,
20 cc's nitric acid. A little proverbial wound. And it throws him out of sick. Oh, it was great.
I mean, was it The Darkling?
The Darkling, yeah.
It was not a great episode, but it was Bob Picardo playing evil. And it's fantastic just to see him get to go there.
Oh, well, speaking of Paris there, so we get to the point where the Paris is going to shoot himself and the program ends, and you get the holodeck grid again. And I don't know what I was going to say about that, but the idea we have two, I guess that we have two Robbie Duncan McNeils on the screen at the same time. It reminded me of the two Kirks in Star Trek VI.
Right. I think I was mentioning that to you before the show, or it might have been in the news. Anyway, how you have Kirk and you have the two Kirks and then you have Riker and then there's two Rikers. So now we have Paris sort of donning that same ladies' man. And of course, you've got to have more than one of them. And that's always fantastic. One thing really stood out to me, as you mentioned that scene again, is how detailed the holodeck has gotten, the holodeck set itself. Remember back in TNG, it was just this room with the little yellow lines on it. And now it's this like crazy thing with these, you know, it's really detailed metal work. They've obviously spent, you know, they spent about as much to build the holodeck in Voyager as they spent on the bridge on Next Gen.
Don't you love how on Voyager that somehow the energy source for the holodeck is like not tied into the rest of the ship's systems. So when they have system resource problems at the beginning of the series, it's like they can't replicate food. They've got to go down and pick roots and stuff off planets, but they can run the holodeck as much as they want because somehow it has
it's
a different power source.
They hung a lantern on it, Chris. So just move on. They talked about it. Just move on.
Oh, I just love that moment.
It's so funny because Voyager has some great elements to it, but you get to talking about Voyager and you get anywhere near like an inch or two beneath the surface, and it just behooves you to speak about all the stuff that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
and I feel so bad for beating up on the show, but it's anyway.
I do want to say overall, I really do. You know, I don't know if we're getting into the end show here, but I really do like this episode. You know,
no,
I think it's comments on the show itself, especially the whole scene where Tom and Tuvok are trying to write the rest of the holonovel is really fantastic. And as you said, the beginning of it where it's commenting on the Maquis and trying to do more with that and sort of show a what if, that's really great. It's as you say, the more you look at it, the more you think about it, the more you complain about the ending, the more you're just like, I'd rather be watching DS9.
Yeah. No, I really like this episode as well. It's one of my favorite Voyager episodes, to be honest, because it's fun and it's interesting.
Yeah,
I almost think it would have worked better in season 2 instead of season 3. I think they let so much time go by that the idea was just so implausible at that point that it didn't quite suck you in the way that it could have, maybe. Michael, you said you feel bad about beating up on the show, but it's not exactly beating up the show. I mean, Voyager's, it has its good moments and its bad moments. I think that And I like Voyager. I like all the series, but I like Voyager too. I think that it's often when we get into discussions about Voyager, though, we do become very critical because of a lot of disappointments about the missed opportunities within the show.
Oh, yeah, most right. definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. No, I don't mean to characterize us as being too mean. I just, you know, I guess it's easy to criticize something that you love, if that makes a little bit of sense. You know what I mean? Because Voyager is plugged into the Star Trek universe, and so kind of by default, I give it a wide berth. But even then, you know, you're sitting here and you say it correctly. I mean, it's seeing what could have been and what wasn't, and that's, you know, that's sad.
Yeah, but what I always come back to with Voyager is how much I love the characters. That I really do like Tom Paris. I do really like B'Elanna and Tuvok.
Yeah, the Doctor for the 10 seconds he's there.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe, you know, Janeway and Chakotay, we can have a whole thing about them. But all of the rest of the crew, I really love. And every time I watch the show, I love how free they are. They don't feel like this... I don't know what the word is, but in Next Gen, you always feel like everybody who's not Riker is really tied down. You know, maybe Geordi gets to be excited from time to time, but nobody gets to have any fun. And as you say, this is a fun episode, and I love it when the show is able to do that.
What you're saying is on Next Generation, people just, except for Geordi maybe, they don't get to do a barrel roll.
Do a barrel roll! The barrel roll!
Nice.
That is what I'm saying, Chris. And yes, perfect.
But of course, on here they can.
I do want to mention something that stuck with me from the first viewing of this episode. Can we kind of award maybe like worst prop to this episode? Like, I feel like I was watching the show and I'm thinking about it. Like, this show was shot in 1997 or whatever it was, and everything is just, the quality is so wonderful for it being as old a show as it is. And Star Trek has always kind of excelled at creating really awesome production quality, or, you know, since the early 90s anyway. But, man, that scene in the Jefferies tube when the plasma fire shows up and then that fire extinguisher shows up on the wall. And it's like a dowel stuck into a bigger dowel. And they're like painted silver. And then the effect of the plasma extinguishing, you know, foam or whatever it is just... Everything about it is just so wrong and bad.
You're absolutely right. That's exactly, as you started to talk about it, I was thinking, that's what he's going to talk about.
And I remember thinking that watching this on like an 11-inch color TV in my kitchen when the episode first aired, I'm like, what is that POS he's got in his hand?
Well, B'Elanna didn't have much time to program it, so she just, you know, went with the first thing that came into her mind, didn't really have time to put texture on it.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, the holodeck probably has, you know, there's like a floating palette where you just drag and drop props, and then if you have time, you know, you can put textures on them.
You can really make them look
fantastic. And she probably just used like the, I don't know, the fire extinguisher tool palette, and she just dragged
the base model
went off there, and popped it on the wall. She said, "No one's ever going to go in here anyway, so I don't need to put detail." And sure enough, that's the thing that gets shown.
That's the thing that,
gosh, always happens in holo novels.
You know.
All right. Well, maybe we should wrap up here the discussion. So I guess our basic conclusion to all of this seems to be that DS9 did conflict well and Voyager didn't. Is that basically what it comes down to? At least the mock.
Is that the main bullet point of this presentation?
No, it's just, I think that, again, this is one of my favorite episodes of Voyager. It just highlights for me one of my biggest disappointments, which was that they spent so much energy setting up the whole Maquis to the point of planting the seeds of it in the Next Generation in a number of episodes, although they didn't actually call them the Maquis, but they set up the whole Federation Cardassian treaty and how the colonies end up on different sides, and then they devote two episodes of Deep Space Nine to establishing the Maquis in order to launch Voyager, and then after all of that effort, it just gets abandoned so quickly. And that disappointed me.
Yeah.
And I think that this episode coming at a point when you've already accepted the fact that that conflict's not going to be there. And then this episode comes up at the end of season three, and it just reminds you of what could have been and wasn't.
although, you know, at the very least, we can take solace in the fact that Voyager still remembers how to use the original series episode ending template of the crew sitting around and laughing at a not very funny joke. Right?
Well, what we need though is Tom Paris over by the turbo lift door, about to cough up a lung, slapping his knee.
Right. Yeah. In the vein of
when someone says, yes. Tuvok, you are a stubborn man, and then everyone cracks up laughing.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. There are a lot of similarities between Voyager and the original series, actually. In some ways, I always felt that part of their goal there was to kind of recapture a little bit of that unknown exploration of the original series, which kind of got lost in the later series as the Federation and the politics between all the different empires became very, very intense.
Yeah. And, you know, I think original series is very campy at points, and it got away with being campy because of, well, various factors. But by the time Voyager rolled around, you have a franchise that has so much weight associated with it. And this is what J.J. Abrams was talking about when he was making the film in 2009. There's just so much baggage associated with Star Trek that you, I guess, when you're making it at that point, you can't help but to be a little bit self-important, a little bit pretentious in the, you know, in the production of it, and then it doesn't pay off, and you can't really get away with as much camp. And when you try and do it, you do a half measure, like the joke at the end of this episode, which is, you know, something like, "What did Tuvok say? I assure you, the next time I will pick a subject less close to home."
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And somehow
like
that's a joke, and everyone cracks up for 10 seconds, and then, right. You know, fade to black. Why? Anyway, it's funny.
All right. Any last thoughts, Greg?
No, actually, I think you and Mike summed it up pretty well. I do love this episode. I was talking with somebody, forget actually who, about how seasons 2 and 3 of Voyager were really fantastic. And when the show does don the cat suit, it does, you know, it's not that it becomes Star Trek Borg, but it does become a different kind of show. And I think I enjoy the episodes that are more like this. You know, what I like about Voyager is when it's more original series, when it has more fun with itself, and I like it less the more it tries to be DS9.
Yeah.
And I think that's something the writers were aware of, and I think that's part of why Ron Moore didn't mesh as well, because he wanted the show to be more like DS9, and that just... I don't know that it wouldn't have... My sense is, with what they'd set up and the characters they created, that wasn't going to work. What would work is an episode like this that's very, very much more jokey and self-referential. It reminds me of the film Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is one of my favorite films, in that it's always just going back and talking about itself, and it never takes itself too seriously. And I think when Voyager can do that, it's its most successful.
Yeah, I agree on that point for sure. All right, well, why don't we wrap up today? And Michael, thanks for joining us again. Why don't you take a quick moment and tell everybody where they can find you around the intrawebs?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Fats Rikerbeard, spelled like it sounds. And feel free to follow me there for a 15 or 20% Star Trek tweet rate. And the rest is sometimes funny and sometimes weird. And guys, thank you for having me on again. And Greg, I did not say hello to you when this podcast started, so hello. I'm sorry.
Thanks for being with us, Michael. As always, it's great. It's, you know, it's hard to get people to be here the day after New Year's. I really appreciate you being the least hungover person we know.
Oh, you overestimate me, sir. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, Greg. Well, it was fun to talk about the Maquis and the worst case scenario, one of the more fun episodes of Voyager. And great to have Michael with us today as well.
Yeah, it really was great. Yeah, Chris, I'm really glad that I waited till this moment to make any sort of Christmas with the Cardassians joke. Because if you could run back the through my head as that whole feature, I kept thinking, this would be a good time to say Christmas with the Cardassians.
Oh, I'm so sorry that you didn't get to say that during the feature, but I'm so glad that you made sure that you got to say it in the closing.
It It's not even a joke. It's just a thing that I'm saying.
It's just eating away at you the whole time, right?
It really is. But no, I always love talking about Voyager. I actually have another Voyager episode I'm wanting to do. So hopefully we'll get back to Voyager before too long.
All right. And what episode is that?
That's Blood Fever, which features my favorite Vulcan, played by Alexander Enberg. I can never remember his name. It's Torvik or Tarvik or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, I love that character, and I love the episode itself. So
now, do you want to do this just so that we can drink blood nog while we're recording?
Did we talk about the blood nog yet on the show itself?
Actually, I don't know if we did or not. Maybe that was pre-show. You know,
might have been the pre-show.
We should record our pre-shows and release them as supplemental material. We got about 20 minutes worth of show before we actually start recording.
Yes. Yeah. I really wish I'd had some Romulan ale last night. You know, maybe that should be my new Christmas tradition. You know, I'll have blood nog while watching Shades of Grey, and then New Year's Eve I can have Romulan ale.
Oh, but you watch Shades of Grey at McDonald's, so you're going to get the Mech blood nog shake?
99 cents for a limited time.
Right. And you get a free glass with that too, right? If you, at least that's what happens in Japan right now. Anyway.
I don't know if they don't do that sort of thing in America. I'm really disappointed. It's a great way to stack up on glasses. Just go to McDonald's every week.
They're doing it right now. But I think it's because they have a bunch of glasses left over from the last World Cup promo or something, because it's the same glass. All right. Anyway, well, let's tell people how to contact us if they want to say anything about what we've talked about today. You can go to trek.fm/contact and send us a text message there. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can call 646-652-TREK and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. And also, you can find us on Twitter, talking about Star Trek all the time. And that's at username TrekFM. And Greg, everyone can find you and your riveting Twitter stream as well at...
Right. So I'm at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARBIN. Although actually I've been tweeting from Trek FM a little bit more recently. I've been finding some new friends to talk with. So hopefully I can continue with that the next few weeks. But yes, on my main feed, I've been talking about mainly Battlestar Galactica recently. So
all right. Well,
we'll see if that continues.
It's better than Full House or whatever that was in the past, right?
I was never watching Full House, Chris. I don't know why you thought I was listening or watching Full House.
Okay, I don't know. Maybe it's just because, as I've said before, they play it like 18 times a day on Japanese television still after all these years.
Right.
I don't know what the Japanese fascination is with Full House, but it is goodness. Real, unlike the Hollow novel in Worst Case Scenario.
Right.
All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. You'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and over on Google Plus at our own short link, which is hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. And also, we'd like to say thank you to everyone who has rated us and left reviews of us on iTunes for The Ready Room. We're up to 11 now, all 5 stars, and we really appreciate all that from everybody. If you do want to drop by iTunes and leave us a rating or review, it does help other fans find the show. And also, we should remind everyone that you can find us now on Stitcher as well, in your Stitcher app. If you don't use iTunes, if you don't want to stream from the website, Stitcher is a great way to get the show as well on the go wherever you are. All right, Greg, well, it looks like that does it for another Ready Room. I'm going to go and write my own ending to the Hollow novel.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick a malfunctioning phaser in it, because the Ready Room is done.